Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Nada Hashemi, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of Islam, Secularism, and Liberal Democracy Towards Democratic Theory for Muslim Societies, and The People Reloaded, The Green Movement, and the Struggle for Iran's Future. His latest book, co-authored with Danny Postel, is The Syria Dilemma. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nada Hashemi.
Happy to be with you.
And let's start with the first issue, and that is what came up in a recent, or a couple of weeks ago, I interviewed the former CIA officer, Bob Baer, who'd spent a lot of time in Syria and Lebanon, and he stays in touch with the Alawite officers and intelligence people he's known over the years. And he's pretty much convinced that the chemical attack was in response or in retaliation to the slaughter of a bunch of Alawite villages that are very close to where the Assads were born, their natal village. And it was really just a simple, straightforward kind of tribal tit-for-tat, if you will, that on the 19th of August, the Syrian army finally retook these villages that the al-Nusra and other jihadi groups in the Syrian opposition had taken and had slaughtered everybody in a very graphic and provocative way. And the Alawite community was so outraged that they basically forced the regime, whose job it is to protect them, to up the ante, and that's why a couple of days later they used chemical weapons. Do you buy that theory?
You know, I haven't investigated it. This is actually the first I'm hearing it. I haven't read Bob Baer's sort of reports on this. Even if it were true, the use of chemical weapons is widely viewed in the international community as a banned weapon, as a weapon of mass destruction, and it clearly implicates the Assad regime in engaging in a war crime, if not a crime against humanity, on a colossal scale that can't be compared with, you know, tit-for-tat sort of sectarian clashes that have been taking place in Syria over the past 2 years. So if this is an attempt to somehow try and justify the use of chemical weapons, and we now know this is not the first time the Assad regime has used chemical weapons, I think it's a very pathetic justification. If we were to believe the American intelligence reports, you know, on one day, in less than a day, in less than an hour, 1,500 civilians were killed, 426 children were gassed with sarin gas. So I don't think, you know, these reports, assuming that they are true, can anyway sort of justify not only the use of chemical weapons, but I think if one looks at the overwhelming bigger picture of what's happening in Syria, we have, you know, a one-family dynasty that's been in power for 43 years that has killed over 100,000 people, overwhelmingly civilians, and we have the worst humanitarian crisis of the 20th century unfolding before our eyes, and most of the responsibility for this particular crisis can be laid at the doorstep of the Assad regime and its attempt to hold on to power. So I think we shouldn't sort of let little stories that emerge somehow blind us from the bigger reality that has been unfolding before our eyes, and that's that compromises and constitutes the tragedy of Syria today.
Well, indeed, I don't think anybody's suggesting that this is any way a justification for what the Assads did. It's more of a question of answering the question, or at least filling in the gap, that this is not a completely insane, psychotic regime that's totally motivated by irrational evil, that they didn't wake up one day and said, let's use chemical weapons because, you know, we're just evil people. They did it because there was a reason within their very, very obviously unpleasant frame of mind. And it's true, it's a family plantation. They've owned this country, right, and they really believe that they have a divine right to rule.
Right. But no, you know what? I mean, the story in and of itself, assuming it's true, does provide a possible theory or explanation as to why Assad used chemical weapons, because, you know, one of the immediate sort of debates that ensued in the aftermath is, you know, why would the Assad regime do this given the consequences that could flow from it? It didn't seem rational. I agree this is a regime that is rational. It's not sort of psychotic in the sense that it doesn't want to commit instead of suicide. It is trying to preserve its power, and it's doing everything it can to perpetuate its rule. So, you know, the story does in and of itself sort of possibly, assuming that if it's true, does perhaps provide some context as to why they decided to drop chemical weapons on a suburb of Damascus. But so, I mean, that's an interesting conversation to pursue.
Sure.
The point that I'm concerned about is that we shouldn't lose sight of the larger picture of what's been taking place in Syria and the broader political context in terms of how the Syrian revolution began and how it's unfolded and what the international community could or should be doing at this moment.
Well, in that regard, Nat Hashemi, I think there is a connection in as much as the deal, the Russian-American deal, and there's some evidence that the whole deal was prompted in when Secretary of State John Kerry made his off-the-cuff remark at the press conference in London when asked, is there any way we can avoid bombing, or the Syrian regime can avoid being bombed by the U.S. because of the chemical weapons use? Kerry sort of offhandedly said, well, you know, if they got rid of all their chemical weapons in a week, but they're not going to do that. And apparently the Iranians seized on that and managed to lean on the Assad regime to take the deal. The Iranians didn't want to take credit for it because they recognized their sort of political kryptonite and allowed the Russians to take the lead. That's my understanding. Is that your understanding?
That is my basic understanding. I mean, there's a convergence of opinion among all of the key players, the United States, the Assad regime, the Russians, and the Iranians. They all agree that they don't want to see any further external intervention taking place. And so in many ways, the proposal that was made to sort of remove the chemical weapons out of Syria in exchange for the United States, you know, committing itself not to engage in military strikes satisfied all of the key parties. And, of course, you know, many people were celebrating this as a huge step forward, but, of course, it is a huge distraction, and it fundamentally, you know, doesn't solve the underlying problems of Syria. And in fact, if one looks at the casualty figures since the use of chemical weapons on the 21st of August of this year, approximately 3,000, if not more, Syrians have been killed. We're talking about within the last, you know, couple of months, in 2 months only. So the killing continues. And so the chemical weapons, I think, agreement is not to be celebrated. It satisfies the interests of many of the key players, but it certainly doesn't satisfy the interests of the vast majority of the Syrian people who continue to suffer under this brutal regime. But it is important to point out here, and I think there is some lessons to be learned, that we got this chemical agreement to the extent that one wants to sort of consider it a victory. This chemical weapons agreement only happened and could only have happened with the credible threat of force that the United States was directing at the Assad regime. Had that not happened, they would not have capitulated. And so I think there's broader lessons there in terms of what needs to happen to promote a political settlement in this part of the world. Simply sort of wishing it to happen or hoping that the parties can come to a negotiating table in Geneva and everyone will agree and the Assad regime will sort of willfully and openly negotiate its own exit from power is, you know, wishful thinking at best.
Again, I'm speaking with Nat Hashemi, who's the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Kobil School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of Islam, Secularism, and Liberal Democracy, Towards a Democratic Theory of Muslim Societies, and The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future. His latest book, co-authored with Danny Postel, is The Syria Dilemma. So the deal, which is being celebrated, of course, allows the Assads to stay in power. And I think when you say that the only reason it happened was that there was a credible threat of force, that sort of flies in the face of much of the opposition at the time. And you know that the president was responding, I think, in part to the Congress and to the polls that indicated the American people are overwhelmingly against another war in the Middle East. But it would seem to me that given the reaction by the Saudis and by the Turks, that they're very upset with the United States for not taking out Assad. And the fact that Assad took the deal that the Iranians suggested he take was he knew that he was avoiding, I think, regime change, was he not? I mean, do you think that had the U.S. gone ahead and struck Syria, it wouldn't have been a pinprick?
Well, the United States was claiming at the time that it would just be a limited strike and it was just simply meant to send a message. And I think that in and of itself really sent had a chilling effect on the Assad regime. They wanted to do everything that they could to avoid any sort of military strike that could have sort of inspired the opposition forces, that could have weakened the Assad regime. Assad did everything in his power to avoid that particular option and you know, very revealingly conceded and turned over his entire chemical weapons arsenal, a chemical weapons arsenal, by the way, which, you know, the previous day he claimed that he didn't have and he didn't use. And so I think that was the motive for the Assad regime to sort of capitulate on this particular issue, because he really felt that this could possibly be a game changer, even if it was a limited strike. If you talk to sort of many people in the Syrian opposition, they are deeply upset that the military strike didn't take place, because they thought that even if it was a limited one, it would still have shaken the Assad regime. It could have led to more defections. It would have at least had a psychologically emboldening effect on the opposition forces, that the balance of power on the ground perhaps is starting to shift. So I think those are the calculations that were taking place at that time. But of course, now we are at a different moment. It's widely viewed, and it's now acknowledged and I think accepted. The Syrian National Coalition accepts the fact and has acknowledged the fact that there is going to be no external assistance of a significant degree that can tip the balance of power on the ground in their benefit, and so they're going to have to make a decision as to whether they want to go to the negotiating table, go to the Geneva conference next month, and try and get the best deal possible. So those are sort of some of the, I think, perspectives that were out there with respect to the events that that were related to the use of chemical weapons and the consequences of a possible military strike in the aftermath of the use of those weapons.
And Nada Hashemi, your book, The Syria Dilemma, is a compilation of all of the leading scholars on Syria and the leading analysts. So it provides an overview of all of the very complexities of this struggle, and the latest complexity, of course, is that the Kurdish Peshmerga militia are now at war with the al-Nusra, the jihadis who taken over that rebel area of the Kurdish area of Syria that borders on Turkey and Iraq. And that's led to a fairly severe battle that's going on as we speak. So there's another dimension that the al-Nusra people, the jihadis, have put out a fatwa against Kurds as heretics. And right. So they're at war. So there's many layers to this.
The longer the conflict drags on, the more complicated and messy it gets, the more there are internal sort of conflicts and squabbles between the forces that mobilized to oppose the Assad regime. And I think this is just the tip of the iceberg. I see the longer that this thing drags on, the more you're going to see these type of intersectarian, inter-ideological sort of clashes in Syria that sort of, you know, just highlight how tragic this conflict has become. It initially was, for the first, you know, 6 to 8 months, an overwhelmingly peaceful, nonviolent, democratic and non-sectarian uprising. I think we should not forget, you know, the origins of this conflict. And there really were two sides. There was the Assad regime, and then there was the nonviolent opposition that spontaneously emerged in the context of the Arab Spring. But as a consequence of the repression of the regime, crushing those revolts, and also critically, and it's important, I think, for your listeners to appreciate this fact, largely because the international community, in particular, large parts of the North American and European left, because they abandoned the Syrian revolution, they really didn't have much to say, they really didn't have much interest, they didn't get involved when they could have gotten involved, the conflict is now sort of degenerated to this particular level, and my prediction is it's only going to get worse.
So why do you think the European and American left abandoned the Syrian opposition, who were initially nonviolent and were being slaughtered in the streets for protesting against this dictatorship that's, you know, been there for over 40 years, and a very brutal and pervasive dictatorship run by ubiquitous Muhabarat, the secret police? On the one hand, these are the same people that celebrated Tahrir Square and the revolution in Egypt, but somehow turned their back on the Syrians. What's your explanation for that?
Well, of course, I think one has to be fair. There's not sort of one American left or European left. There are different sort of strands and perspectives within that movement. I mean, the extreme elements of the American and European left, some of them sort of had a certain sympathy and empathy toward Assad because he allegedly sort of was part of this axis of resistance against American and Israeli policy. And so those elements of the left really didn't care about having that regime, that so-called axis of resistance, weakened. But I think the broad mainstream of the left, unfortunately, has a very American-centric view of the world, and by extension, if I can say this, and also a very narcissistic view of the world. In other words, they view the entire world through the prism of their own particular internal debates here in the United States and their own opposition, much of it very legitimate to sort of U.S. foreign policy globally. And so my reading of the left's reaction or lack of action with respect to the uprising in Syria is because, you know, the United States really didn't get involved at the beginning of the uprising. It sort of made statements. And the broad position of the American left tends to be they tend to sit on their rear ends and they wait and see what position the United States is going to take. And then they make a 180-degree turn and they adopt the opposite position. And I think, you know, we've seen that manifest itself in many different ways. And so because the United States wasn't directly involved, and if you look at the debates, there was all this discussion about the U.S. role in Syria and the U.S. sort of getting involved in sort of, you know, arming some elements of the rebel opposition. And the truth was that the United States really never got involved in any serious or significant way. The most that was sent were sort of non-lethal, sort of small arms at best, and that was sort of a drop in a bucket in terms of the balance of power on the ground. But the primary intervening forces, if one wants to talk about the problem of foreign intervention in Syria, was Iranian, Russian, and Hezbollah intervention. And, of course, that doesn't concern the American left because the American left is only concerned about U.S. intervention. And there are times when I think it's appropriate to be concerned about U.S. intervention. But what do you do in a case like Syria when the primary intervening countries and entities are not the United States or its allies, and they are committing atrocities that are borderline genocidal? And so the left really doesn't have, I think, a coherent ideological position. So they really didn't get involved in Syria, and they don't really care. And if you look at a lot of the narratives and the discussions and the debates, there's a lot of sort of confusion over how to respond. The role that the United States is playing is elevated and exaggerated, and that of Russia, Iran, and Hezbollah, and particularly the Assad regime, is diminished in the moral narratives and in the political interpretations of the Syrian conflict. And we've seen this time and time again. I mean, I see a lot of parallels and echoes to what happened in Bosnia and in Kosovo, where the American left adopted a very similar position: no interest in commenting or getting involved and coming to the rescue of the people of Bosnia when they were facing a genocidal sort of Serbian nationalist intervention that destroyed that country. But as soon as the United States sort of got involved, then there were howls of outrage and opposition toward the United States in ways that I think really don't stand up to critical or moral scrutiny.
Well, just in the last minute or so here, Nader Hashemi, let's turn to the fact that we have these strange alliances in effect between Israel and Saudi Arabia. They're both angry at the United States, as is Turkey, for not intervening. A senior Israeli diplomat said the United States did a lot of damage to their image by failing to attack Syria. We know the Turks are annoyed and the Saudis are furious, and they're talking about maybe changing their whole political orientation because they're also angry at the way the United States allowed Mubarak to fall, as are the Israelis. And both the Saudis and the Israelis are supporting this military coup in Egypt. So you have some strange bedfellows there. Just give us your analysis on those changing, you know, the fact that I think in the vacuum that you're talking about of U.S. intervention, the Saudis are going to probably up their ante, which will need more jihadis on the rebel side, which of course plays right into Assad's hands.
Well, on that last point, I think we have to be careful. The Saudi intervention in Syria has not been supporting the extremist jihadi elements. In fact, the Saudi and Qatari intervention have been supporting some of the more moderate elements. The jihadi presence and the al-Qaeda presence in Syria is getting support and sustenance from private charities in the Gulf. So one has to make that distinction. There was a big piece in the New York Times just a couple of days on this, where the Saudis are actually very wary and very fearful of arming sort of different groups in Syria out of fear of a repetition of what happened in Afghanistan, that these rebel groups will then come back and sort of cause problems for the Saudi ruling family. So I think that's a point that I think hasn't been clarified. And there's actually an essay in our book by Thomas Pierret. I think it's the last essay in our book that actually goes into some description as to how this is playing itself out. But broadly speaking, with respect to your question, I think, you know, you have all the major players in the region, Saudi Arabia, Israel, Turkey, they're all pursuing their own national interests. And there's some overlap in terms of their national interests converging with respect to Syria and wanting to see the Assad regime toppled and wanting to see the United States get involved militarily. But I think it's important to point out that there's not a unified strategy here. There's a convergence of interest. The Israelis have their own reasons for wanting to see the United States involved militarily. That's largely because of their obsession with Iran. The Saudis have, you know, their own agenda that they're pursuing, and that has to do with their fear of Iranian hegemony in the Middle East and hoping to sort of topple an ally of Iran so that Saudi Arabia can expand its influence. It has no interest in democracy or democratization. The Turks have their own sort of agenda. So there's really sort of separate, you know, nationalist, I think, agendas that are being pursued by the ruling elites of all of these countries. They happen to all converge, and it just, you know, creates a very complex and difficult situation for outside observers. But, of course, the biggest losers in all of this is now Syria has become a battleground for all of these regional agendas. And the biggest losers, of course, are the Syrian people who really began an uprising without any interest in resolving these regional debates. They simply wanted to topple a brutal 43-year one-family dictatorship and try and promote a political transition toward democracy so they could have a decent sort of chance at a reasonable future and a decent life. But because of the conflict has dragged on, because of where Syria is located, because of these regional international rivalries, we have this, you know, very chaotic situation that has unfolded, and it's, in my prediction, is going to continue for a very long time to come.
Well, Nader Hashemi, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks for the opportunity, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Nader Hashemi, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of Islam, Secularism, and Liberal Democracy, Towards a Democratic Theory for Muslim Societies, and The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future. His latest book, co-edited with Danny Postel, is The Syria Dilemma. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer David Rushert. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared.